From an early age, we're all immersed in sport. For some, it fails to ignite a spark inside us, but for those of us who catch the fire, it's the beginning of a lifelong journey filled with highs and lows, which all matter far more than they should. After all, it's just a game, we're told. Sport is a certainty, it's a point of reference in an increasingly uncertain world, and the bonds formed with either sport in general or a hometown club transcend both time and generations. Today, much of what sport has always meant to true fans has been somehow lost in a blizzard of corporate communications, fireworks, and froth. The attachments that were once so strong seem more trivial in the global age of televised sport as entertainment. What was once authentic has become increasingly staged. In this podcast, we'll get back to the things that sport has always meant to true fans. We'll take you from the boardroom to the dressing room to the pitch, but we'll do it not as a corporate communication, but as true fans of sport, and we'll do it with authenticity. We'll be honest and we'll speak our minds. This is a podcast for true sports fans, and the one thing all fans have in common is a passion for the game. Now, we certainly don't mean to cause any offence, so if you find yourself taking any, just shrug it off and get back in the game, because this is about the game, and the game is bigger than all of us.
We've got some fresh new young talent doing some things that I know you haven't heard before.
Listen.
Well, welcome everybody to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? Joining me this week, as always, from somewhere in the lake, is Roger Mitchell. Roger, there?
Yes, I am. How are you, Grant?
Mate, I'm very, very well. I'm in New York City. James is in the Cayman Islands, hopefully. He's pretending to be anyway. I'm not sure if he is. And you're in Lake Como, so
yeah.
The band are back together.
Yeah. Thanks, now, James, for getting up at 4 in the morning.
Yeah. God bless you, James. No, thanks to me for getting up at 5. There's a massive difference, obviously. But still. Now, we have a very special guest this week joining us shortly. The golfer Eddie Pepperell. Eddie is a real character. He's a fantastic young man. He's a great golfer, and he's just an all-around top bloke, and I think you're really going to enjoy listening to him. I've gotten to know him a little bit over the last sort of 6 to 8 months, and I can tell you he's fantastic company.
Looking forward to that, a lot more perhaps
than many of you are going to expect. So I'm going to let you find out for yourselves when we talk to Eddie. But before that, Rog, I know there's one thing this week that I know you're going to want to talk about, and let's see if I'm right. If you're going to talk about one thing this week, what would it be?
Well, you probably have to talk about Billy McNeil.
I got it in one.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a risk that, you know, these things become repetitive. But, you know, in Billy McNeil's case, I had the fortune to meet him a couple of times, both in a more professional capacity when I was there in Scotland at the league. But as a younger man, as a Celtic fan, I met him a couple of times. And then as a Celtic fan, he absolutely is the icon for that club. Raising that European Cup as the first British player to do that, high, with that look on his face, is truly iconic for any Celtic fan. And, you know, everything he's done in his career, glorious career, has just been covered with class. And I really loved so many of the foreign clubs, you know, taking the time to put, not just the usual, you know, our thoughts are with the family of Billy McNeil. They put some real meaningful comments in there about how he represented, you know, the culture and the authenticity of European football for the last 30, 40 years. So it's a sad day for the Celtic family, but I'm so pleased he got what he deserved with the accolades.
Yeah, no, it did. And I mean, you passed on to me a wonderful piece that Jim Kerr wrote about,
yeah,
which you know, perhaps you can share that again on Twitter once this show goes up, because it was poignant, and you could just sense what the man meant to true fans of the club.
Yeah, as you know, we've had Jim on here, and you got a sense of what growing up in Glasgow from our Celtic family it was all about, and Billy McNeil absolutely was the brand of that, the icon of that. And you know, all of this team from 1967, the first British team to win the European Cup, they won every cup they went into this year, that year. they're passing on now. It's obviously their time. And as I was saying to somebody, it's difficult to explain, but you feel that a little piece of you goes every time one of them passes away. You know, it's a specific memory of them. It's a specific memory of the shirt, the wear, the number they had on their back. And bit by bit, it's fading away. And, you know, that probably sounds incredibly sugary. But you know, as Jim wrote, it's absolutely the case for somebody of my background.
Well, it isn't, it isn't, Roger. I mean, if you think about how few iconic images there were of that time relative to the amount of imagery that is generated today, you know, in 60 years, you're going to have the Messis and the Ronaldos of the world. Can you imagine the tributes to those guys, given all the footage that there is of them, given all the images of them, and the fact that they've symbolized football for a generation? You know, Billy McNeil was from a time when the coverage wasn't wall-to-wall. There weren't 50 cameras at every game. No. We don't have his life on film, and that I think makes the memories that much more powerful, because you're picking them from your own mind, and obviously,
yes,
whenever
point.
You're pulling them from your own mind, they're always going to be, you know, he's going to be a little bit bigger and a little bit better and than he was in real life, because he was a giant to you, and I think that's a great thing. I think to be able to remember these guys in your own mind, as opposed to from multiple cameras, is a better thing.
It's not just about the field, you know. It represents for all of us. This was a team that did all that they did, and then they did it again in 1970, beating the cream of English football in Leeds, which was a magnificent team.
Well, so let's not get carried away.
They did it for about 5 years, where they were undoubtedly in the top three in Europe. And this team was brought together by blokes that were within a stone's throw distance of the ground. I mean, get your head around that today. You know, like, you know, these millennials, and, you know, Eddie's one of them, and they it's a different world now. This was a team that was basically the Glasgow City Council select. And you know, they get together, they've got that whole Gallus Glaswegian thing going on, they don't take themselves too seriously, a whole lot of jokers on that team, and they go out to the fields of Europe and they just knock them down one after the other, and then he goes up and he holds that cup, you know. So RIP Billy McNeil.
RIP Billy McNeil indeed. Well, look, let's let's get to our guest. I'm going to do this intro before we actually talk to Eddie, so, because he'll hate me for saying what a bloody good bloke he is, but he just is. I mean, he's a talented golfer. He's won a couple of tour events on the European Tour. He came third in the Players' Championship back in March. I saw him play at Augusta, and yeah, that is a stage. He looks so comfortable. He looks like he belongs. And I think he's going to win an awful lot of golf tournaments. I think Eddie's going to be a true star in the golfing world. And I say, better than all that, Rog, he's just, as you're about to find out, a fantastic, fantastic guy from a great family. He's got a good support network around him. I spent time with him, and they're just solid people. So
splendid.
Let's bring him in and have a chat with Eddie Pepperell. Well, Eddie, welcome to Are You Not Entertained? Thanks so much for taking the time. I know you are busy backwards and forwards across the Atlantic these days. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Thanks for having me on. I'm not sure how entertaining I'm going to be, but we'll see. The travel's been quite tough, actually, on my body. I'll be honest. I had a back injury at the end of last year, and I've been battling through that this year, I would say, up until this point. And it's not, I wouldn't say it's in a perfect state, to say the very least, but you know, it's, my travels are coming to an end, really, thankfully, across the pond. So, I'm looking forward to just having a bit more localized travel, really.
And have you had the whole family traveling back to Vaux, or have they just gone to the glamour events?
Oh, they just went to the Masters, and that was, let me tell you, more than enough. My girlfriend's been with me for the whole time there, which is good. We've now called them my emotional support dogs. So I have two in my life now.
Not to her face, I hope.
God.
No, she calls herself that, actually, now, which is kind of sweet. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I had the good fortune of meeting all your family at Augusta. We'll talk about that a bit later on. But first, I just want to go into your background. There's a whole bunch of stuff I'm interested in kind of talking about. The first is kind of how you got into golf. I mean, I kind of half know the story, but I want to hear it from the emotional support horse's mouth if we can.
It was pretty standard, really. My dad just got into it. My dad worked at Rover for 25 years and then decided to take redundancy out of the blue. And at the time, me and my brother Joe, he's a couple of years older than me, but we were young. I was 4 and he was 6. And my dad just kind of took up golf, and I think he loved Jack Nicklaus. And, you know, that's how we got into it. And before we knew it, we were playing a lot. We were competitive, the pair of us, me and my brother, and, you know, loved it. I mean, I loved that and I loved football growing up. But once I reached 12, 13, I figured at that early age that I didn't like the parents and I liked being on my own. So golf was the obvious choice.
Now, football, which football team do you support? You're an Arsenal fan, aren't you?
No, I just like giving them stick on Twitter. I'm not really much of a football fan. I mean, historically, I was a Chelsea fan, but I've kind of gone off football, really. But I've decided I like stories. The day I realised I'm not really a Chelsea fan was the day I think Leicester beat Chelsea at some point coming towards the end of the season when they won the league, and I wanted Leicester to beat Chelsea. And I figured, I'm not a Chelsea fan. I just like stories. So, you know, yeah, that's kind of how I see sport now, really.
This is why you and I get on so well, you know, because this whole story thing, I totally agree. I mean, I think everybody in the country wanted Leicester to beat Chelsea, even Chelsea fans. I honestly think, I mean, Chelsea were out of the race. You shouldn't feel too bad about it. But as a Fulham fan, I'm glad that there's one less Chelsea fan in the world. So your brother and you growing up, obviously you said competitive golf. I mean, you know, my brother and I were that kind of age apart. How did that go? Because obviously, you know, your brother's a teaching pro, right?
Yeah, he is. I think we always had ambitions to be golfers in terms of, you know, what I'm doing now. It just so happened that once we reached, well, I mean, there was a stage in Joe's junior golf that I remember quite vividly, and I didn't experience this, and I kind of think it's the reason maybe as to why I carried on and maybe he didn't in the competitive sense, is that he would really struggle with anxiety and being sick on the way to junior tournaments, and I wouldn't. And I think, you know, when you're young, that can be super off-putting, and you know, you've got to kind of, it's very difficult at that age to understand that, well, A, that's natural and happens to everyone, but what it means as well. And I think Joe never really loved that, and whereas I really enjoyed competing. So you know, I think that was the difference ultimately between the two of us. Joe's a good player, but you know, we're different in our characters for sure. But no, I mean, we were super competitive, certainly growing up, with everything we did. Like most brothers, you know, it was usually on the computer, to be honest, and I would end up, he would always win, and I'd end up smashing the controllers. So yeah,
Eddie, that's so interesting you talk about that, because In my background in the football world, anytime you speak to, you know, elite athletes like yourself, very quickly they come around to this thing about temperament or ability to bounce back from something that's not going so well. And they always say that it's 80-90% in the head. I mean, you've really got a strong temperament. I think you've proven that the last couple of years. But, you know, how do you develop that, or do you just have it naturally, or do you have to work on it? How does that happen, Eddie?
Truthfully, obviously, I don't know for sure. I think character is inevitably part of our makeup genetically and biologically, obviously passed down from mum and dad and whatnot. So there's an element of that. However, you know, there are your individual philosophical beliefs, which I think, in my case, I think have played a fairly significant role in the way I've approached or indeed reflected on failure and setbacks. And so, you know, I think there are certainly things you can do on an individual level, and maybe I've done them. You know, I mean, referring to what my brother there and saying, you know, when he used to be sick and struggle with those types of things, I kind of have always just accepted those, and as I've gotten older, certainly realized that actually they're universal. You know, you're not often unique. In fact, I think the beauty of life is that we think and feel many of the same things, actually. The difference is the way in which we react. So just identifying that these things, whether it's anxiety or fear or whatever it might be, they tend to be universal things. So it can make you actually much more comfortable in your own skin just by simply being aware of that. And that's something over the years, as I've gotten older, that I think I've indeed done better. And I think that allows me to kind of approach new situations more calmly and more composed, in a more composed manner. And indeed, then when things don't go so well, you can reflect on them, you know, more adequately or indeed correctly even.
That makes sense. Eddie, it does make sense, but it's so interesting that I'd like to ask, I mean, like philosophical beliefs, are you somebody that's studied that kind of stuff? Are you somebody that's a deep thinker around literature and books? And, you know, I know Grant is, and you know, maybe that's one of the reasons you both got on so well. Is that something you'd really have a good contemplation on?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I didn't study anything at school. So, I mean, it was certainly later learning and through reading and whatnot. And actually more through just observation. I mean, you haven't even got to observe just yourself. Wow. In fact, it's true. You know, we could obviously look at anyone, any sportsman. And I think the big thing for me actually was when I did start reading books, and whether it was often actually rugby players. I remember reading Lawrence Dallaglio's book and reading about what happened to him and his sister and the setbacks that he had. And you know, and Johnny Wilkinson also. And Johnny Wilkinson was a sportsman that I held in such high regard, and I had this image of him being perfect, that when you read his book and you get an insight into his own demons, you realize, wow, he's actually extremely flawed as an individual in many ways. And so that had a huge impact on me, because then it certainly made me feel less concerned about my own flaws or whatever. And really made me realize you can be enormously successful in life in spite of your flaws. So there's that. I mean, the other thing for me in terms of a kind of a philosophical approach to life is that, you know, my battle, and indeed my future, I think my future battle will be how to not be too apathetic towards things, because, you know, my general feeling is that I'm not very important and I'm not that significant. And so
God. My God.
That drives certain things in a good way, but it also can lead it can manifest itself in some bad ways, obviously, and a form of nihilism and things that we maybe see, you know, among younger people these days. And that's certainly not something that you want to become. So I'm aware of that. So, you know, I battle these things myself a little bit, but, you know, that's the way I've kind of come to feel and think, I guess, about things.
Yeah, it's fascinating talking about this stuff, Eddie, because it's your golf is, as you made the point earlier on about being alone. You know, golf is that one sport where, you know, rugby, you get chance after chance within a match, but then you get time to reflect and then you have another match later on. But with golf, you know, you have to instantly just put anything bad that happens behind you. You know, any bad shot that you don't hit quite right, or you plug in a bunker, you know, all this kind of luck that you've got no control over in golf. And it's such a difficult thing to do. You know, speaking as an incredibly talented golfer myself, you know, I understand these problems. But how do you do that? How do you, because obviously there's a lot more importance to your golf. The bad shots matter. For me, they don't. But how do you just put them behind you? Or have you found that really easy? Because that's the thing a lot of people struggle with, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I focus, at this point in my career, my focus is almost unanimous on skill and technical aspects of golf. So, you know, I'm personally a big believer in technique, particularly when it comes to a game like golf, because I believe golf's a very skillful game. It's a game of skill. Yeah. So, you know, you need great technique. So, you know, at this point in my career, that's kind of almost what I focus on. So every bad shot, or indeed every shot, good or bad, the results are kind of very, they're obvious, actually. They would be exactly what I would expect based on what I've just done in terms of my swing or my putting stroke or whatever it might be, whatever technical aspect of the game. So, you know, I kind of tend to focus on it that way. And, you know, the mindset, I found my mindset has either gotten better or worse over recent years as a direct correlation or consequence of my technique and my general understanding of my technical skill level, if that makes sense. So when I've become more skilled and I have more understanding of what I'm doing, have more understanding, then my mindset is very, very calm. And there's no point, there's no need to get angry. I generally only get angry and frustrated when I don't really understand what's happening. So that's where I focus almost all my energy and time is on that level, or on that part of the game, really.
Well, you know, it's fascinating because I did see you at Augusta, and I was just struck by how calm you were. And I think I said to you afterwards, you just looked like you belonged in that company. Nothing seemed to faze you. Nothing seemed to sort of take you out of your rhythm. You weren't one of these guys who was obviously so intently focused that they weren't taking the moment in. Am I completely reading that wrong? Were you just hiding all that stuff? Or, I mean, how were you feeling at that? Because obviously it's every golfer's dream to play in the Masters.
Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, that particular week, I think, you were there on the Friday from memory. I remember seeing you on the Friday. And that day, I ground really hard to make the cut.
You did.
And I was struggling, you know, there was a little delay. I wasn't playing great. So it was, I wasn't that bothered. I mean, I was frustrated with the way I was swinging it and the way I was putting. So I wanted to improve that. But I dare I say it, there were a number of greens where I was just stood around after making another bogey, and I kind of thought, oh, I'm ready to kind of move on from here. and I didn't like feeling that at the Masters. You know, I wanted to stand on every green and soak it in and just, and there were the occasional moment that week where I did that, but there were also some moments where I actually felt, dare I say it, uninterested. And that wasn't a reflection of the tournament or what it means to me. It was just a reflection of my own personal feelings towards my game at that current moment. And it seems that I feel that way regardless of the tournament. And I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. Honestly, from a performance perspective, I think it's actually a good thing. But when it comes to the more sentimental things that we like to sensationalize and make stories of, it's clearly not ideal. But
at what point do you, because I followed you around and I chatted with your folks who, and we'll talk about them later because they're just fantastic people, but at what point did you was it the birdie on I think 16 that got you fired? Because there was that, just that moment, that amazing par you made in 18, there was just a little fist pump when that putt went in.
Was that
a great par, or did you realize about the cut line?
No, I knew that was a pretty important putt. I realized it was an important putt for the wrong reason. Because when I had my little delay on, I just birdied 15, the storm, I hit my shot into 16, and then the hooter went or whatever, you get called off for 20 minutes. I went on my phone, checked the cut line, and I misread the cut, actually. I saw the cut was at +3, but I remember thinking that +3 was in like 50th position with some amateurs. So I remember thinking +3 safe. So when I parred the last to +3, I thought I'm safe because I remember seeing that position. And then I went in and saw that position was +2. The only reason I was in was because the leaders were only on 7 under. So and then I started thinking, oh shit, I mean, I might not make this cut. And obviously then it was the worst thing because all the way home on the car journey, everyone's on their phone seeing if Adam Scott's making birdies and cheering when he doesn't. And then obviously we took the TV on when we got home and we saw Louis plug it in the bunk on the last or whatever. And then obviously when Tiger didn't hold a birdie putt in 17, that was the loudest roar I've ever heard in the house with my family. I felt so bad because, you know, you're basically, you don't want someone to have someone else to do well, because you want to be there for the weekend. So I hated that. It's always the worst, one of the worst things when that happens. But no, it meant a lot. I mean, that par up 18, I sort of knew what was on it. And of course, you know, when you're that close to the margin, you want to be on the right side of it. You want to fall on the right side of it. I've fallen on the wrong side of it enough times to know how much it stings. And because I knew I was going to be in America the next week anyway, it was like, well, I'd like to play the weekend just to save, to fill time, frankly, because I'd have been bored otherwise.
Eddie, I must admit, even these 10 minutes are giving me a quite a different impression of who you are. My dad also worked in the car business. He was in the line at Chrysler. And he was a golfer as well. I played a little bit, but I had no talent in it. But one thing I do remember about golf is that it's a place where you kind of like put on a persona, that you're trying to control emotions, that you're, and you know, there's a lot of funny stories around that, you know, about people that seem to be completely very, very calm, and then on the third shot that they duff, you know, they start hurling clubs around their heads. You're really coming across to me as somebody that is quite different from the persona that you put out there, which, you know, I think is a very good one anyway. But Is that persona, that kind of like jokey, you know, you're not going to take yourself too seriously, is that deliberate or is it a reaction to what clearly is somebody that is a very deep thinker about a whole lot of things in life?
Well, that's a good question, I suppose. I mean, I do think there are sides to me, and I think probably sides to everyone, but I mean, Twitter is clearly a particular side of me where I'm more facetious and jokey. And then there's the blogs that I do, and then, yeah, you know, there's me on a more individual level when I'm on my own. And when I'm on my own, and, you know, I'm quite reflective, I'm quite introspective, yeah, and I, you know, I just think a lot, and I talk to myself and do all these things, and that's, you know, I'm kind of keeping myself going in that sense. So, you know, I find that I can be a lot of different people. You know, I think there's a lyric from Richard Ashcroft, actually, in that famous song, Bittersweet Symphony. I can't remember exactly how it goes, but it's a good lyric about him being a million different people from one day to the next. Yeah, and so...
Wow, I mean, Eddie, wow. Love it. Just, you know, I love this.
But, yeah, I don't know. I don't know really how to answer that question. I like to think that I'm somewhat natural, just being myself, but I kind of don't know. I mean, I think Twitter, unfortunately, does bring out a more narcissistic side to everyone, and I'm not excluding myself from that, and I don't like that about myself, indeed, about Twitter. But, and there's an element of performance and acting on that front, for sure. But, you know, I still think that's a better way to do it than be the corporate whore that many people are.
Eddie, I agree with that, but I also think, you know, the you know, when you say you were a little bit hungover for the last round there, I absolutely buy that, and I understand that, because, you know, people don't realise that sports elite athletes are humans, and you know, I've known cricketers that have gone out into the middle and faced really serious fast bowlers, and they're half baked. You know, and footballers that it happens a lot. And you, honestly, you strike me as somebody that doesn't want to hide the realities. And it's just, in this podcast, super authentic. And, you know, I'm so pleased that you've taken the time to explain it to us.
Well, Eddie, let's talk about that, because that one incident was something which kind of, were you surprised at the amount of press? Because you and I chatted about this when we played golf, and obviously, you weren't incoherent drunk. You'd had a couple of glasses of wine, right? Which a lot of us would do over dinner.
Absolutely.
Were you surprised at the reaction to that? And did it kind of affect you, or did you just kind of shrug it off?
I mean, thankfully, I'd already played the round of golf. So it wasn't on my mind during the round. I mean, listen, the thing is, I had a bottle of wine, right, the Saturday night of Carnoustie. I was angry at the way I'd finished on the Saturday, and basically thought I'd lost my chance to win the Open. So, you know, I kind of done something that I've actually done quite a few times over the last few years, and that's go and have a few drinks with a couple friends and have fun and relax. Yeah. And I kind of think a lot of guys would do that. I mean, maybe less so in this day and age, but still some people are going to do that. So the irony there was, it wasn't the first time I've ever done it. But obviously dropping it into the interview was, it provided a good soundbite, and it was, I guess, quite amusing. But, you know, I didn't, I don't know. I mean, it's certainly every time I go to America now, I still get, that's what I'm most known for, really, it seems, the hangover, you know, and I still have just guys all the time in America. Shang, you know, how many beers did you have last night? And I want to turn around and say, I only drink wine, you dickhead. But, you know, you've got to be careful.
You do, but it's funny, because it's that, you and I chatted about this, but that, use Roger's word, authenticity, that's what people kind of gravitate towards. You know, you talked about the amount of corporate whores there are in sport, and it's so true, right? All these guys who you know are spouting the company line. And, you know, as I followed you around Augusta that day, the love for you in that gallery, who, let's face it, a lot of them didn't really know who you were, but the people who did they loved you. It was amazing to listen to their thoughts about you and talk about what a great kid you were and how, you know, this is a guy that he had a few beers, what a top lad. It was fascinating to me, because I think everywhere in life we've had this move towards corporate culture and homogeneous output in every possible facet of life. And you are a guy in a world which, you know, non-golfers think golf is bland. It's known as a bland sport. And suddenly here comes a character who's not afraid to say what he thinks and does it with a kind of smile on his face and a wink in his eye. And I think that is so sorely missed in sport today, that you simply being that person is the crowd are going to come to you because of it, because they're desperately looking for personalities.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're dead right. It's obviously weird for me to say that about myself, I think I would say that about anyone if I was taking the objective perspective. I think you're right. I mean, I think it's not just in sport. I think it's in society. You know, I think there's a general lack of authenticity, whether you're watching news, listen to politicians, listen to sportsmen, whoever you're listening to, it seems those in the public eye, there's an unwillingness or even an afraidness to actually say what they're truly thinking. And, you know, on a couple of fronts, whether it's political or religious fronts, I try to keep myself very central. I try to keep my perspective as wide as I can. I don't really want to go down rabbit holes on those important topics that can lead to that can lead to trouble. But there are certain topics where I can very much be an individual and say almost what I want. And I just have to identify and be very careful what they are throughout my career to not cause any trouble. But, you know, I agree with you. I hate it myself. You know, I can't stand the whole PC culture or the corporate, whatever it is, you know, that just unfortunately puts a facade over the reality of something. I love reality. Like, for me, you know, the realer something is, for good or bad, I mean, I love nature. I mean, I love evolution, because to me, it doesn't discriminate. It just is what it is. And whether you like it or dislike it, it's a fact and it just happens. And I kind of can't help but just be addicted to that. I think it's beautiful, and I don't see a problem with imperfection. In fact, I think it's actually what joins us together, and I just wish that we celebrated that more in our culture, but it seems at the moment we're not.
Man, Eddie, this is, listen, you know, I don't want to get too deep on this, but you know that I think this is great. But let me tell you something I really liked about, you talked about Freddie Couples. You know, like Freddie Couples as a golfer, you know, has never been, you know, one of the ones that, you know, he's won the Masters and everything like that, but he was always a little bit of a maverick on the outside with that beautiful, beautiful swing. And then, you know, you make that comment on Twitter that he came up to you. You know, tell us a little bit about, you know, what that meant and, you know, what he said. Because I think a lot of us understand what you were talking about when you mentioned Freddie.
Yeah, I mean, I was just walking off the range on I think it was the Tuesday, I was going to play 9, and I just heard someone chatting my name. Hey, Eddie. And I was like, turn around, and it's Freddie Couples. And I'm stood with these two Patriot members wearing the green jackets, and I said, what on earth does Fred Couples want with me? You know, and they didn't have a clue. Fred Couples comes over and shakes my hand, and well, actually give me a fist bump. The traditional Fred Couples fist bump. He just said, listen, I'm a big fan of yours. I get up at 6 to watch the golf in Europe, so I quite often see you on TV and, you know, like what you do. And he actually then patted me on the hip and said, have a great week. And listen, he seemed very, well, he's obviously very, very friendly, it seemed very genuine. I mean, I've since had people on Twitter tell me that he does that to everyone, every rookie, which, you know, I might be true. I mean, it might let some of the air out of the balloon that I felt that day. But, you know, it was still very nice. And whether he does that to everyone or not, frankly, it doesn't really matter. I just think it's a very nice thing to do. So, you know, he seemed very, very, very friendly. And actually, I'd watched a documentary with him with David Ferrety. I think they did a two-piece special on the Golf Channel because you know, it's always on in America. So I ended up watching some of that. And he came across very well on that, I thought. So he's clearly a cool character and, you know, it's nice.
Well, let's stay on Augusta, because there's one other thing I want to talk to you about there. Well, at least one, and that's your final round with Jeff Knox, or sorry, the third round with Jeff Knox. He's something of a local legend there. what was that like? Talk a little bit about who, because most people won't know who he is. Yeah, so just talk a little bit about who he is, what you knew about it going into the round with him, and what you found as you went round.
Well, I knew nothing. I didn't even know that there was a marker at the Masters. So it wasn't until that night when everyone on Twitter, and in fact, I remember you messaged me as well, saying, listen, this guy has beaten Rory. This guy can play. you know, and I was just all of a sudden thought, oh God, there's actually way more on this now tomorrow than I want there to be. I don't want to lose Jeff Knox. So he was great. I mean, he's such a good player. I mean, that was the thing that struck me. He stood on the first tee, and there's a lot of people there on the first tee that Saturday morning, considering the first off. And he just stands up there and absolutely roasts the driver. And he's got a beautiful swing. And I thought, I mean, if I'd have played him around Harbour Town where I played last week, there's no chance. He might have won the tournament. it was just too long for him, the course, that day, the way it was playing. But, you know, he was great. Really nice guy. Good player. He's very respectful. I really enjoyed his company, actually. It was good.
I love the comment about that you're officially better than Rory now when you came off the team.
I hope. I'm sure Rory will get that.
So let's talk about your amateur career a little bit, because you know, your contemporaries when you were playing amateur golf, you know, we're talking Tommy Fleetwood and a lot of those guys.
Yeah. Tommy was. I grew up with playing with Tommy, really.
So what, you know, who else was in that group, and what was the kind of atmosphere and the camaraderie like, and how's that translated into the tour? Because you seem to be a group that harkens back to the 80s when the European tour golfers were all kind of buddies and travelled together and drank together and had a good time together.
Yeah, you know, we don't do that, to be fair. Like, I never spend time with Tommy on the road, but there's, you know, within all of us, there's a mutual respect, there's a friendship, there's almost a kinship, because we've grown up together. And so anything, I could never imagine any of us falling out, if that makes sense. And I think that represents more of a friendship than a friendship sometimes, you know, because, so, I mean, you know, for Tom Lewis, a good friend of mine, Laurie Cantor, who's not maybe doing as well as some of us at the moment, but, you know, he could do. I'm close to a couple of the guys for sure. The thing with Tommy that I respect the most about Tommy is he was always the first out of our little cohort to achieve something. And he seems to be doing that now as well at this, you know, highest level. And I kind of admire that, because that's difficult. You know, it's easy to follow on from someone, really. It's easier, but to be the lead guy, which Tommy's always been. And, you know, he's great. You know, he's great for British golf. He's great for golf. And, you know, I always felt very lucky, really, to be alongside Tommy and people like that. So, you know, my amateur career was, I wouldn't say in any way spectacular at all. I was probably a better junior than I was an amateur, for whatever reason. But, it was fun growing up and just spending time with everyone and going on the trips and traveling in a group of friends. You know, you have great times and good laugh. And you don't really do that now as a pro on tour. It's more individual, but,
at what point did you realize that you weren't just good, you were tour good? Because there's a big difference. There's a big gap up from being a good golfer to being able to make it on the tour.
Yeah, you're right. It would have been honestly as late as 2014, 2015, when I was actually on tour, proving to myself. I lost my card in 2016, but that didn't really shake me. It didn't shake my foundations, because, you know, I just felt very lost with my game, but it didn't shake any characteristic foundations or whatnot. You know, I knew I was good enough. And then obviously the last couple of years, there's been more steps to even higher levels. And, you know, I think until you take those steps, you don't really know that you're good enough. I mean, you can believe it. But I think there's nothing as powerful as actually knowing it. Certainly if you want to replicate something. You know, it was probably quite later than many people might imagine.
Eddie, I'd like to come back to your dad and Jack Nicklaus. Tell me why he was your dad's hero, and how that translated to you. And did you rebel in any way and prefer other golfers? Were you a Watson guy? I always like to understand who somebody's heroes were. I think it says a lot about them.
Roger, I'm a millennial, so I've never asked my dad one question.
So you just think that's not true, mate. You had those Nicholas Stitch socks on. You're secretly really just listening to your dad.
Yeah, well, you see, I only did that because I was playing at Arnold Palmer's place.
I know.
Lovely. No, I honestly don't know. I honestly don't know why my dad chose Jack Nicklaus. I couldn't tell you. My dad's always been into football, so he was never into golf. You know, he was never a golf fan. He's a big football fan, so he just took up golf. And I think for whatever reason, he just got a Jack Nicklaus video. I think Jack Nicklaus maybe used to do golf videos, did he? Or swing tip videos? On the VHS or whatever. And I remember my dad playing those back in the day. So I think it was just more that than anything.
So who would your kind of like immediate guy that inspired you be? Would it have been Seve? Would it have been Greg Norman?
Honestly, it's no one. I mean, I've never seen any footage of Seve, really, other than the odd bit of clip you see online these days. I don't know what anyone's achieved, really. Obviously, I grew up watching Tiger Woods, so Tiger was the guy, although I always loved Sergio Garcia. He was the one golfer that I always loved watching the most, it seemed. Yeah. But, you know, in terms of idols and these types of things, I just never had any affinity for any individual. I really struggle with that.
Just going back to your family, we jump around all over the place, but this is just what Roger and I do because we enjoy the conversation so
absolutely.
Much. But,
there's no structure to this.
But just going back to your family, because as I said, I chatted with your folks on Friday as we were in the gallery, and it's clear where you get that grounded feeling from. I mean, your folks were just lovely. I had a chat with your dad for a few minutes, and he said, "Do you want a beer?" I said, "That's very kind of you. Thank you very much." Yeah, you're not going to get that in the US, and we just chatted. You know, it was obvious how proud they were of you. It was obvious how happy they were, and I mean how they were just soaking in the whole atmosphere of being at Augusta. And I think it's the first time anyone at Augusta's seen a Pepper Army t-shirt on. That was your cousin Kaz walking around. He was easy to spot in the gallery. And I had a chat with Jen, your girlfriend, and you have around you just. It seems to me the perfect group of people for your personality. You know, they're as laid back as you. They're not going to add stress to you by them getting caught up in the moment that when you're not. I mean, does that group work, or you kind of were you joking about how traveling with your family, and I know that feeling well, can get on your week after a while.
I mean, my dad's never been that pushy. He's never been pushy at all, actually. And I think the other thing, whether that's because that's his nature or whether because he knows my nature and that I'm quite stubborn and that I've always seemed to be quite driven and know what I want, whether I get that right or wrong in terms of my decision-making, well, that can pan out. And he's obviously had concerns in the past, particularly surrounding my Twitter. But, I mean, in terms of my my nature, I think he knows that I'm pretty stubborn and driven and single-minded is the term. So I think maybe they've all responded to that. And so they kind of just think, well, Eddie will do what he wants to do at the end of the day. So there's really no point in me even having any input. I can gently advise him, but, and I'm aware that that's my nature as well. And so that's part of the reason why I've been careful in many of the books I've read or the information I take in, because, you know, I want to make sure that it's the right stuff so that I can make as best decisions as possible. I mean, Jen, I've been with Jen for over 11 years, so we're,
good.
And she's very smart. You know, she's studied law and all that sad stuff. So she's, she's way more intelligent than I am. So, I think they probably react more. They've reacted and they've just grown to understand more what I'm like, really, as an individual. So, it's pretty stress free, I guess. Although it wouldn't be from their perspective. I know mum and dad would be much more, stressed than I probably am about many things. But that was the beautiful thing with the Masters is just seeing them all enjoy it. I mean, when I arrived on the Monday and drove up Magnolia Lane, and I thought this is lovely, and I texted the group straight away. I was like, you guys are going to love it, and I was just excited to see them.
Yeah.
Their response and how much they loved it, and that was it for me, it was nice to see.
Eddie, I think it's coming across quite well, the kind of personality that you've got. You didn't give me anything on heroes, so I'm going to push on this. You talk about reading books, you've talked about a little bit music and the Verve. Give me some books you've read, some films you really like, your best albums, artists. Give me a better feel about what's the thing that really takes care of your leisure time.
Yeah, so, I mean, originally, in terms of my reading, it was Malcolm Gladwell, I was quite a fan of. Right. And then as I got more and more into, I kind of went into politics for a short period, and then I got more into economics, and then I read Michael Lewis's books, which I enjoyed. I mean, because I found that he was talking about very serious subjects or quite serious events, but in a way that was quite entertaining. And then, you know, that kind of moved on to, you know, I know Grant's on the phone, but, you know, I've listened and watched a bunch of Grant stuff online, and the Real Vision stuff and that type of thing, and I really enjoy that. So,
yeah,
you know, in terms of what I consume on that front, that would be that. I mean, music, you know, as I've gotten older, I've loved the Smiths. I think that, you know, I've become a big fan of the Smiths, the Stone Roses. Richard Ashcroft.
You really are deep. Richard. You really are deep, mate.
I'm unfortunately. And I mean, some of my favourite films, you know, if I could watch two films on repeat, it would be probably World War Z and The Big Short, and they're both just full of destruction and despair. And I seem to be attracted to that. I don't like to watch a film and laugh. I like to watch a film and somehow feel frightened or something. So, I, you know, it is concerning, but that seems to be what floats my boat, really.
Can I make a wee comment about World War Z? Because, you know, in some of the sports teaching that I do, or executive teaching using sport to be more correct, I use that clip in the film, the one about the 10th man, you know? So he goes to Jerusalem, they've got a wall around it, and they say, he says to them, "How the hell did you know?" And they said, "Well, we heard about the symptoms and everybody thought the usual things." And the 10th man in the corner said, "Well, what if it's a fucking zombie?" You know? And you know, then he talk about, you know, well, that's how Israel works, because, you know, nobody thought that they would be invaded in the 73 or whatever it was, things like that. And it's the kind of like the 10th man, the corporate jester, the fool, you know, that role in the Shakespeare plays where there's this guy dressed a little bit funny, but actually he's the wisest guy on stage. That whole thing there.
You're listening to The Movie Show with Eddie Pepperell and Roger Mitchell.
Yeah, well, let's get Jonathan Ross in, shall we?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I'm going to take you back to golf, because there's a lot of the stuff that I'm really fascinated with, and I want to talk about your first win on tour, because I'm just fascinated to know you'd lost a playoff at that point, I think, a couple of years earlier, which must have been an interesting thing to go through. But judging by your character, you probably kind of shook that off. But when you get in contention, and you have this habit of making up big deficits on the last day by playing really steady golf. Just talk us through the emotions of that first win in Qatar.
Well, unusually, I felt particularly calm. I mean, that week in Qatar, I was tied with Ollie Fisher going into the Sunday, and we had, I think, a 3-shot lead ahead from the guy in third or whatever. So, you know, it wasn't a 2-horse race necessarily, but it looked like it could be. And then Ollie had a bad start, and all of a sudden I was leading by 3. But, you know, I felt very comfortable. The reason being was because I remember that week I had a swing feeling. I just started with a new coach. A swing feeling that was related more to my body as opposed to my arms. And I've always been under the impression that it's much easier to achieve that under pressure than it is, you know, with your arms, basically, than you want the bigger muscles kind of taking over. So I kind of felt quietly confident knowing that, well, this could actually, for the first time in my career, this could really work under pressure. And that's kind of what happened. And so playing with the lead felt very, very easy. And that also happened at the British Masters, when the second time I won last year, obviously, is I felt very comfortable in the lead because I just felt like I had swing feelings that brought about very particular misses. So, you know, it's golf. Yeah, you want to hit great shots, but you really don't want to miss two ways. If you can have a one-directional miss, or certainly swing feelings that can give you very clear-cut misses, as power. And I had that last year, and I think that's part of, I've kind of had a bit of that this year as well. So, you know, I felt very comfortable and confident in that position purely based on what I was seeing and feeling in my swings and the results of the shots. So, you know, which I hadn't felt before, really.
But at the risk of asking a trite question, what did that first win mean to you? Was it simply Was it a relief? Was it just proof to yourself that you belonged at that level? Did it change your mindset in any way?
No, it was just really relief at the time. I didn't prove anything to myself. It was just relief that you got the monkey off your back. You've won a golf tournament on the European Tour, so no one's going to ever ask you that question again. And then I think as time went on after that, it gave me confidence. I mean, certainly when I think back to the Scottish Open last year, which I came second, but, you know, got beat by a guy who nearly shot 59. I mean, you know, I felt very, very comfortable in the lead at that point in the tournament at the end until he overtook me. So, it did a lot for me in terms of my confidence, and only really winning can do that, I suppose.
But now, obviously, you're in that position where the US Tour is kind of, if not officially beckoning, you know that this is a decision that at some point you're going to have to make as to whether to stick to the European Tour or try your luck on the USPGA Tour. Have the last sort of 6 weeks of this year, you know, we'll talk about the Players' Championship specifically, but have the last 6 weeks kind of swayed you in either direction? Because for some people, they just can't stand being in the US and doing all the traveling and stuff, but other people just really love it.
Yeah, we didn't love it, but we didn't hate it, but we didn't love it. I in an ideal world would play both tours. I have certainly no ambition to play in America full time. I love playing in Europe. I think European Tour has some huge events, which I really enjoy playing. So from my perspective, the schedule I've got this year, if someone offered me that for a decade, I would probably take it. It would purely just depend on my body. How does my body handle that, and how well can I manage my body? The stress of all the travel. That's something I'm going to have to weigh up. But, I've kind of surprised myself a little bit this year with what I have done in America, because I haven't played well. I haven't swung the club well at one tournament this year. Statistics would back that up, and I've certainly felt that. I've had a back injury, which I've just come off, which my back is still... I mean, I'm going to have to take 6 weeks off pretty soon just to allow some form of rest. And, you know, it's a new environment. It's a PGA Tour. It's a new place. Don't know what to expect. I knew the standard was going to be better, and it is. In all fairness. So, you know, when I weigh it all up and I add all those things together and think, well, I've done third in the Players and, you know, had a decent one last week, and I've accumulated obviously a lot of money over there. It's kind of great. I mean, it's great for me, and it's definitely going to add to my confidence. And I've been a little surprised by that, I suppose, because mostly due to the fact that I just don't feel like I've swung the club the way I really can or have done in the past when I've played well in Europe. The only difference I would say is my short game and putting has probably been better in America, or certainly my putting, which I kind of anticipated might happen because I generally putt better on faster greens, providing they're pretty flat, which they weren't at Augusta, and I was pretty useless on them, as you saw firsthand, Grant. So,
well, listen, I didn't want to say anything, and I certainly wasn't going to give you any tips halfway around, but we could talk about that off air.
Yeah, that was not good.
Eddie, I read somewhere that you were saying that your putting had really taken a different level last year and this year. Can I ask you a little bit about somebody that comes from my part of the world, who Molinari, who as a younger player, I may be wrong on this, but I don't think so, he was always a really good steady striker, but was pretty poor putting. And you know, how much of golf really at the end of the day is driving for show and putting for dough?
Well, statistically, you want to be a better ball striker than you do putting. And that's not only statistically true, but that would also, on a personal level, be true of me over the last 2 years. So, you know, I've had the most success I've had over the last 2 years, but it was almost entirely built off ball striking. So, the modern statistics are really quite fascinating, actually. I'm not that into statistics or numbers, but one thing it has helped me identify is a form of a DNA. And by getting the feedback, and it's become quite obvious to me my big strengths and my weaknesses. So, for example, with me over the last 2 years, my biggest strength when I've played well has been my iron play. At times I've been fantastic, and even at times statistically the best in the world. And I'm not just saying that; that's what stats would show.
Yeah.
But I've been quite poor with my driver, and I've been quite poor on the greens, and I've been good around the greens. So my DNA, if for me to have good results, would generally be hit my irons well, be good around the greens, and try not to drive it or putt like a clown. I mean, that's as simple as that. If I didn't putt like an idiot, I would do well. I would definitely have a top 10. And if I putted well, I would probably win. I mean, even the tournament in Qatar last year, statistically speaking, I was worse than average in the field on the greens. but I was so much better than average with my irons that I still won the golf tournament. So, you know, this is why Tiger's, the numbers, as you dive in and you look back historically, they figured that Tiger was so good because he was so good with his irons. And that's what we're seeing again now. And, yeah, you know, you see it at Augusta, his iron play is just it's amazing. And
fascinating.
It's, I think, the most important part of the game is your iron play. And listen, because of my own swing characteristics and my natural tendencies, I'm, whichever way you want to look at it, I'm fortunate enough for that to have that potential to be a very good iron player. And I know that that needs to be my primary focus. And then from there, things like putting, you just don't want to be a bad putter. You haven't got to be a great putter. You just don't want to be a bad one. You can't afford to be bad, you know. So, Francesco Molinari would probably fit that bill as well. I've played with him. He's probably the most impressive player I've ever played with. He is like a robot. And, you know, again, he's not become a great putter, but he's just stopped being a bad putter. And look what's happened to his career. I mean, it's
fascinating.
Mm. Yeah, it is amazing. Well, Eddie, let's talk about the Players' Championship, because that, obviously, you can't hide from that. You know, you come third in the Players' Championship and you hole a 49, 50-foot putt on the famous 17th hole. Suddenly, you're news. I mean, it's just, there's no getting away from it. How do you deal with that elevation in the spotlight?
I mean, funny enough, I was watching the TV yesterday and something came on about Sandy Lyle, and it was when he won the Players' Championship remember. It might be the 80s or something.
87,
and he was the first British. Right, he was the first British player to win, and I just thought, oh, that's interesting. They're showing a video of Sandy winning the Players' Championship, so it kind of dawned on me, oh, the Players is a big deal. And then I know that we had some recording on the TV from the highlights, so I went and watched that, and I just watched the putt over again on 17, and it just made me smile, you know. It just made me smile and laugh, because, you know, I kind of had a bit more of an appreciation of the arena, if you like, or of the event, of the stature of the tournament, and then what I've done, and seeing my name, you know, second place at the time or whatever, right up there with the good players in the world. And, you know, it's a nice feeling. But, you know, beyond that, I don't feel too much towards it. It happened very quickly. You know, I was nowhere with nine holes to play, it seemed. And then all of a sudden, playing with Justin Rose really helped, because he was there. And I was trying to hang on to his coattails, and then, you know, I just had a freakish run really around the greens where I was dynamite for a while. There you go. It just happened. But it was great fun. I mean, the 17th hole, and that was the other thing I remember watching with Sandy yesterday on the TV, was there was no stands. You know, it's just people around the whole hole. But now you go there, and it is such an arena, and you're terrified. I mean, you stand on that tee. In fact, when I stood on that tee for the first time on the Wednesday, I hit in the water, and I was pretty nervous for a Wednesday. And I joked to Mick at the time. I said, Mick, the good thing is it can only get better from here. So, and it did. I was 3 under for the hole for the week, which is kind of surprising. But it's such an amazing event. It's my favorite course probably that I've ever played at. I said that before I even did well. I said that on the as soon as I played it. I loved it. It's such a fantastic course and so much fun. It's really made for that event, and I loved it.
How did you find Harbortown? Because obviously both Pete Dye designs, the Harbortown one a lot older. Tough course though.
Yeah. I mean, that was, someone brought that up to me last week, and weirdly enough, I felt like they were very similar weeks in that I didn't feel very good with my swing, but I was only ever really missing the ball right. So, you know, it was weird. I never felt like I hit many good shots, but because I was always missing it in one spot, and I knew that, you could get around the golf course. And I mean, both Sawgrass and Harbortown, I kind of just did not find it difficult to shoot decent scores on it. Whereas I go to some courses and it feels impossible. I mean, it just feels impossible to shoot a good score. So it's weird. You know, I don't know what's in that, but, you know, I don't know if he's dead, Pete Dye. I think he probably is, but it's a shame, really, for my own career. I need more Pete Dye design.
There's plenty out there. There's plenty out there, trust me. Well, I mean, the courses that Pete Dye didn't design, Bethpage, Royal Portrush, and Pebble Beach. You know, you've got three big tournaments coming up. You know, when you look ahead to the rest of the majors this year, you know, is there one you're particularly excited about? Are you just looking forward to the thing now that you know you can win, now that you know you can contend in these big events? Has that changed the way you look forward to them?
I don't know. Maybe it's made me even more anxious. I mean, I think Portrush is the one I'm most looking forward to. It's certainly the one I think, if I'm playing well, I have the most chance of winning. And I would openly admit, I do think I could win the Open. I mean, if as long as I'm playing well, I think I could win the Open, with it being on a links course. Listen, you know, do I think I could win at Bethpage at the USPGA? I mean, it'd be much tougher for me because of the nature of my game and the nature of the way the course is likely to be set up. And of course, the guys at the top of the game who, you know, we talk about game DNA, where they bomb the ball miles, and I don't do that. So, you know, there would be courses that I think would be more preferable to my game. But, yeah, I don't know. It's certainly going to be a lot of fun. I mean, to be honest, as things stand right now, I probably won't play the US Open just because it's I'm going to have some time off to let my back heal. But certainly playing the USPGA and the Open. So, you know, both two great events, obviously, to look forward
to. If you really don't want to play in the US Open, do not win the PGA, all right? Because there's no way they'll let you step away from the Open if you win it.
But that would be my dream. I've said for ages, if I win a big golf tournament or a major, then I could really just allow myself 6 months off. And it would be nice. I can go to Canada finally.
Eddie, every so often in this podcast, we do delve a little bit into the more business side of things. And obviously, from what you've told us about following Grant and Real Vision and everything like that, then I feel we can handle that well. A couple of things I wanted to ask you. Two things. You said you're a millennial, and you know, that's funny because there's this whole generational thing in life in general, and certainly in sport, that the youngsters enjoy a different format and a different way of content. Do you ever think that the four-day golf tournament will have to change to make it more attractive to the younger type audience?
Probably, possibly. I don't know, to be honest. I mean, do I think young people have appetite for content? Absolutely. So, you know, I kind of wonder if, you know, we should be targeting the content in terms of the commentary and the actual content as opposed to the format, i.e. the four-day format, first. So there's that. I mean, I don't know. To be honest with you, is the main answer to that one, Roger. I mean, you know, it's... yeah, I really don't know when it comes to consumption. I mean, kids, it seems that, you know, we move on to one thing pretty quickly these days. But I think, I mean, I listen to the Joe Rogan podcast a lot. And what's fascinating about that podcast is I don't find listening to a 3-hour podcast difficult. And quite often the guests that you listen to are, you know, talking about quite in-depth stuff. And I don't think my attention span is particularly long at all. So I think there is a capability in young people to be, you know, immersed in something for a longer period of time. It's just, I really think it comes down to the content and how, you know, for me, the big thing is the commentary and, you know, how do we go about making that more exciting, more fun? I don't know. It's difficult, but yeah, I don't know exactly the answer to that question.
No, I think you've nailed it bang on, because if there's anybody in the industry that says, yeah, this is the way it's going to go, then they're a liar and probably a charlatan. We're all feeling our way. But your comment about length of podcast and attention span, you know, when we started doing this and our first one was like 90 minutes long and people said, are you insane? And you know, in fact, it works, you know, like people seem to have that attention span if you can just get on the right wavelength. And it's coming back to right at the very start when you talked about stories, you and Grant. I think people want to hear stories. They want to understand a personality. And once they can engage with that personality, you know, you follow a sport. We saw that with the Formula One thing. And you know, that's what I think that's what you have tapped into, whether consciously or not. I think you are bang on the money, mate. Bang on the money.
Well, yeah. And listen, I mean, I think it's inevitably that it's going to change in terms of the whole Sky thing, you know, and golf. I mean, clearly things are changing in terms of the platforms where things are going to be shown. And so it seems quite obvious to me that there's going to be more division, more of a dividing up of coverage, and how that affects things, you know, I don't really know. I mean, it's clear that, you know, young people of my generation frankly, can't afford Sky. So they're not going to get it. And so that's going to hit on the golf. I mean, on many things. So, yeah, how golf goes about getting itself out on different platforms is, you know, it's a huge thing. But when I see, you know, people like, I think it's at PewDiePie, who I came across this year for the first time in my life, a YouTuber with over, I don't know, 80 million, I don't know, followers or something. I just think it's incredible. It's incredible the following that people have on YouTube, which from my perspective, they're not, well, we don't need to get into it, but I, you know, because I'm a new golfer, so I'm hardly providing anything important. But, you know, I it blows my mind. It really blows my mind, really.
You're right. My daughter follows all of our content on YouTube subscriptions, you know, whether it's makeup with a guy called Sister James, you know, like, so let's not go there. But, you know,
is that James, the producer?
Yeah, actually it is. I didn't want that secret to come out, but yeah. So, you know, that you're right. People are thinking, oh, how do I buy the rights and put it on linear TV? And the whole thing's fragmenting and polarizing, and it'll all become consumed in a different way. But, you know, the thing more important for that, the delivery mechanism will change. But what I am convinced about is people will be drawn to personalities in sport that are interesting. And you know, like, as we probably come to the end of this a little bit, Eddie, you know, like, whether it's nihilism or philosophical beliefs or the Smiths, or Richard Ashcroft, man, you know, like, I'll be watching you every round from now on, because this has been fantastic.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks for the nice words.
Yeah, look, and Eddie, it's. I've been looking forward to this for a long, long time. You know, it's. I thoroughly enjoyed our time playing golf together. And it was great to play golf with someone who had just come third in the players, and first of all didn't cancel for a start. I was half expecting you'd be way too big at that point, but to just, you know, your head is so screwed on, right? And, you know, I said to you then, just the one thing, just don't change, because, you know, that authenticity you have is in such rare supply these days that when you see it, it's such a breath of fresh air. So look, thanks for that, and thanks for taking the time to do this. I know you're back and forward across the Atlantic, and you've got plenty of better things to do, so thanks for taking the time. But look, anyone that doesn't follow you on Twitter,
there is a more pressing issue, Grant. I'm sorry, before you go on, but what about the Tesla first quarter results? We've got to talk about those.
Let's do that.
You've put your foot in it on Twitter a few times. I've done it the same. Why not do it live? Yeah, we could talk about the Tesla results all day. I don't think
you must be licking your lips this morning, Grant. They were terrible.
Look, not that that means anything in the wacky world that is Tesla, but it's just, I was listening to a conference call last night, and
you think
you've got no life, Eddie. I mean, God, I was at a Tesla conference call, and I was listening, and I'm just thinking, this is like some reality distortion field. This is like World War Z. If anyone's listening in the States. Yeah. It's so bizarre for someone who spent a life in these markets watching how these things are supposed to work to watch this thing unfold in real time. It's going to be the subject of so many books and so many studies and so many films and documentaries. It's absolutely remarmable. And I'm off on a tangent now. Wrap me up, for God's sake, Roger.
Well, no, I mean, it's, Eddie's right. You know, it will become the poster child story of a whole generation of people who have followed this kind of personality, somebody who's very comfortable with just, you know, shooting off the hip in a totally loose cannon, P.T. Barnum way. You know, but, you know, I come back to what we said a couple of weeks ago. It's boring talking about the numbers and everything like that. What's really interesting is that, you know, previous fans, somebody like Sheryl Crow, you know, she can't get out the fucking car. You know, like, it's just so funny. And then he's on Twitter trying to, like, get her out of the car. It honestly is a parallel universe.
It reminds me a little bit of people. Obviously, try. People want something to be so much that they can never see another alternative. It reminds me a little bit of the Jussie Smollett thing, which I saw this morning.
Yes,
he's going to be taken back on their show, and it's like, well, well, how? I mean, seemingly if you're someone, it doesn't really matter. If you have that, a bit like Donald Trump, I mean, if you have that following, it just does not matter what you do, or it doesn't matter. The fundamentals are out the window. You can never be wrong in the eyes of a few. And it's fascinating. It's amazing. It's amazing.
You know, we got through an entire hour without any controversy, and we brought up Elon Musk, Donald Trump, and Jesse Smollett 30 seconds at the end. And so at least we can assure the comment stream is going to be lively.
So I just wanted to get you guys deplatformed.
Yeah, well, no, thanks for that. Look, you're safe in the UK. No one in England knows who Jesse Smollett is. Actually, Jesse Smollett. His name on there. That was probably deliberate. Listen, Eddie, before we go, for anyone that doesn't follow you on Twitter, you are absolutely a must follow. So tell them how they can do that, because the entertainment never ends. And every time I read your sort of every 14th tweet, I'm sitting going, oh, this is going to be good.
Well, you know, you don't remind me of my dad now, Grant.
Thanks for that, mate. I really appreciate that.
That's not what he says, no. But I'm closing in on 100,000 followers, which in my mind makes me a social media influencer. So that's good news.
I think so too.
No doubt.
I think so too. I think so too. I think the as I said to you the other day, the modelling deals are going to come thick and fast now, I'm sure.
I love that. I love that tweet last night on Arsenal. You know, we were saying that, Eddie, a couple of weeks ago. I mean, what is going on there? You know, like this is, but I mean, I really like that you just do it, because you're not a big football fan, but they deserve it. You know, in some, you know, like we've got a mate, Colin, who follows this and was a guest, but they deserve it because it's just the way it is. It's the way you have to do it almost. You have to, you know, give them a slap.
Well, you see, the thing with the Arsenal tweet, and a lot of people won't get this who are recent followers on my Twitter, because I tweeted things very similar to that about a year ago when Arsene Wenger was in charge. And I started tweeting it because so many Arsenal fans were upset with Wenger, and I was just reveling in the fact they were so upset about something so unimportant. So I kind of would just constantly throw the bait in and wind them up and always let say, you know, it could always be worse. You could be an Arsenal fan. Obviously, he got the sack. And I thought, damn it, there's one of my little Twitter stories gone. I'm going to have to come up with something new that's not very funny, but seems funny to me. So last night when they were 3-0 down, I thought, perfect opportunity. And so to some new followers, they're going to be like, what's going on? But to the hearty old followers, they will know, and they might have enjoyed it.
The inner circle. Well, look, you still haven't given people your Twitter handle. So if you want to get to 100,001,
I'm not worried. Don't worry. If I'm that good, they'll find me. I'll keep it authentic, Grant.
Good for you.
Yeah, good on you. All right. Well, listen, Eddie, thank you again so much. It's been fun. And next time we play golf, hopefully you might even squeak a win. You never know.
Never know. God, yeah, you should have won that. Did you tell me? Yeah, you should have won. 3-putt in the last, Grant.
Look, yes. Damn it. James, cut that. Just cut that. Just end on where I said maybe you'll squeak a win. Cut. Thanks, Eddie, mate. Take care and safe travels.
No, thank you so much. Thanks.
Thanks for having me on, guys. Speak to you soon.
Take care.
That was amazing. Grant.
Isn't he a top lad? Isn't he? He's just.
He had me at philosophical beliefs. You know that. He had me at philosophical beliefs.
I honestly think this kid is going to win a shitload of golf tournaments.
You know, but you know what? I think he may very well do that. But you know, like he's so honest. You know, he says, you know, my biggest challenge going forward is going to be apathy. This is one hell of an interesting guy.
He is. And do you know what? As I say, having spent some time with him and the time around his family, he's just a wonderful young man. You know what I mean? He's kind of, you know, as a grandfather now, you kind of look at people like Eddie and go, do you know what? What a great role model for a generation of kids. Not just golfers, but just to your point, right? He's reflective, he thinks about stuff, but he can laugh at himself, he can laugh at the world. I mean, it's everything you would want if your kids to be, right? You
know,
talented, successful, down to earth, humble. And you know, when we played golf, it was right after the Players, and people, you could see everybody at the golf club was kind of looking at him, because he'd obviously been all over the TV the night before or two nights before. And you could see everyone was kind of going, is that Eddie Pepperell? And he was on the first tee. We
don't think much of his caddy, that old boy.
Exactly right. People were sort of saying, "Excuse me, are you Eddie Pepperell?" And he was, "Oh yeah, you know I am." Oh, well, jolly well done. and he was so gracious with everybody and you know, so humble with it, having, you know, just had a career best performance, arguably, even though he's won a couple of tournaments before, to do that in a tournament of that profile. That, as one of my good friends who was a very, very good golfer said to me, you don't come third in the Players if you're just an average golfer, right? And he was just so down to earth, humble. He's just a great kid. And as I haven't spent time with his family, you know, his mom, his dad, his cousins, his girlfriend, they're just a wonderful group of people. And you know, I wish them all every success, but just to enjoy it, you know. And I think that's the one thing about Eddie that I don't worry about, is he's just going to enjoy it and he's not going to take it.
Yeah, I was super impressed. And I'm a professional cynic these days. I was super impressed. Yeah. Super impressed.
Well, Rog, look, that's all we've got time for another week, I'm afraid. The time does fly. I don't know.
Yeah.
We've got plenty of good guests coming out. I don't want to tease too much. I don't think we should tell people. They just have to tune in, unless you've got some great desire.
I'm a believer that every episode needs to live in its own focus. Next time will be somebody else, and this time, let's, you know, Eddie was great, and people should follow Eddie on Twitter.
Yeah, I'll tell you, even if people didn't, it's at Pepperell Eddie. He's trying to hide and not be at Eddie Pepperell, but at Pepperell Eddie, and he's great entertainment. He's a top lad. Don't take him too seriously. Don't get upset about things. It's all meant to be funny. I promise you that much.
Yeah.
If you want to follow this show, and we hope you do, please follow us on Twitter at EntertainedR. That's the word ARA. Tell your friends. Share the podcast, rate and review us on iTunes if you can. It all helps. If you want to follow me, you can do that very easily by following me at TTMYGH.
And if you want to follow myself, it's RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Rog, as always, it's been
fun. Thanks, Grant. Thanks for
will you say we do it again next week?
Yeah, that'll be great. Thanks for setting that up, mate.
Take care.
Bye. Bye.